This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 166. Today we welcome esteemed lawyer James Sweet to the program to discuss the practice of law and the Christian. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and this is our weekly discussion in which we're going to deal with all sorts of issues, but today we're going to be focusing on Christians practicing in law. We've talked about the role of the law in civil governments on our Christ and Culture series last spring, but today we're actually going to speak with somebody who knows what they're talking about, somebody who actually practices law. So let me introduce first our regular, who's Jared Oliphant, who is Director of Admissions at Westminster Theological Seminary. Welcome back, Jared.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be here.
We're also very pleased to welcome James Sweet, who is a practicing lawyer. We're going to get into his bio and describe his firm and his accomplishments. And he is also on the board here at Westminster Theological Seminary, so he has some involvement and experience not only in the law world, but also in the theological world. So welcome to the program, Jim. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Camden. Delighted to be here, but a quick correction. I'm not yet on the board.
Not yet. Oh, I don't want to be presumptuous.
And actually probably not going to be on the board, given the fact that I represent the university or the seminary on all things legal. It wouldn't make sense for me to be on the board.
Yes.
So I'm still not even an employee of the seminary. I am an independent contractor, but I do advise the board.
Have you been given seminary. A title, Director of Special Programs?
That's correct. Yeah. I am counsel and Director of Special Projects here at Westminster, and I have been for about 4.5 years.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that correction.
Sure.
And we're very pleased to have you. And I should mention, we are very grateful not only for all the work that Mr. Sweet has done for the seminary, but also for our organization, Reform Forum. Jim is instrumental in helping us to incorporate and also to help prepare our 501c3 forms, our IRS Form 1023, which is in the hands of the federal government. And so we are awaiting their mercy.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah. But at some point, hopefully in the next few months, we will be recognized as a tax-exempt organization, which would mean a lot for our organization in terms of our development and our abilities to move forward in our ministry. So if you're able, please pray for that and welcome or join us in thanking Jim for his help in helping us to get all that finished. I certainly couldn't have done it myself.
Well, you're welcome, Camden. It's a wonderful website. I've just gotten even more familiar with it over the past couple of days after you guys asked me to come on here and chat. And
you know, check us out.
Listening to Christ the Center and all of the resources. It's a remarkable website for being so young.
Well, thank you.
Not you young, the website.
Yeah, the website, three or 4 years old. Yeah, thank you very much for that. And as we get started, I should mention, because it's apropos, given what we've just spoken about, that Christ the Center and all of Reform Forum is listener-supported, and we rely on the generous donations and also prayers of all of our listeners and viewers. So if you were able to help us out, please visit us today at reformedforum.org/donate and help to continue supporting our ministry here so that we can distribute and also produce all of our programs and get them out into the hands of people that need to hear them. Jared, do we have any other announcements or any bits of news that we'd like to mention as we get started?
Just one quick thing that I've hit on before, but just a little bit more specifically. Just after this airs, we have a Full Confidence Conference in Vancouver, Canada on the weekend of March 25th, and that's going to be at Faith Presbyterian Church in Vancouver. And Dr. Lubeck is going to be speaking. Dr. David Garner is going to be speaking. John Curry is going to be speaking. And then the next weekend after that, we're going to continue in Canada, and we'll be at Edmonton.
Mm.
And that's at Crestwood.
Gretzky Land.
Yeah, right. In hockey country. Dr. Lane Tipton is going to be speaking. Dr. Dave Garner. So we have some good events coming up if you're even remotely in that area.
Mm. Yeah, here Alberta's beautiful, and the farm country, and of course, hockey country, and the home of the great one.
Yeah.
Before he moved on to bigger and greater things with other teams, but it should be really exciting.
Yeah.
James Dolezal, people might be interested to know, one of our regulars used to pastor in Alberta.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so he has some experience up there. So we know there is a Dutch influence and a solid Reformed influence in that province in Canada.
Yeah, and John Curry is somewhat of a native from there too. So he's getting back to the old country, the motherland.
We could officially call him a U.S. citizen, but he's a Scottish citizen who lived in Canada for many years and now is an American.
Yeah, so. He's an alien all the way around, but a good guy.
In many different ways.
Yeah.
Well, if that's all for today in terms of the news, we should get right into our prime discussion, which is that of Christians' involvement in law. And when I say practicing law, we're not speaking of it in the sense of law gospel. We're speaking of it in the sense of civil governments, civil law, and also criminal law, trying to understand how a Christian should go about living in their world. We're going to try to get at the presuppositions and the foundations of law, how the Bible provides for a civil government, and how that can be ordered, structured, and regulated by a law that is instituted by the people. We can talk about the authority and who should wield it, and also speak about how a Christian should go about not only living in their society and abiding by the law, but also practicing the law and maybe even shaping and forming it through the appropriate channels. So, Mr. Sweet, could you describe a little bit and give us a biographical sketch of yourself? You've had such a storied career. Can you speak about your firm and some of the maybe higher profile cases that you've been involved in so people have a context of who they're listening to?
But as I said to Karen Bishop the other day, if you call me Mr. Sweet one more time, I'm out of here.
Well, I hope Jim's okay. We'll call you Jim.
Jim's just great. I am 1 month away from full-time Medicare, which is really full-time Social Security. So I'm almost 66 years old. Next month, I'm turn 66. So I was one of those post-war babies. I was born in Detroit, and I've never forgiven my mother for that because I only lived there 2 days before we went back home to Minneapolis. My father was drafted, and he was sent pretty quickly to Europe. So I was born in Minneapolis, raised in Minneapolis, a hockey player, as you know, Camden.
Yeah.
I moved to Chicago.
There we go.
Went to high school. Then stayed in town, went to Wheaton College for 4 years, graduated in 67, got drafted, as many of my classmates were in 1967, and rather than give the Army my body for 2 or 3 years, I joined the Navy. So I spent 3 years in the Navy, came back, and I went to law school in the fall of 1970 at the College of William and Mary.
Yeah.
Went there because my wife had always wanted to live in Williamsburg, and I owed it to her because we really didn't have a terrific honeymoon because of the fact that I was drafted almost immediately and we got married while she was still in college. So anyway, she wanted to live in Williamsburg. I said, what a great place to live. So we went to William and Mary, graduated in 1973 and moved to Philadelphia. Took the only professional job before this one at Westminster that I've ever had, and that was with the law firm of Drinker, Biddle, and Reith in 1973 and stayed there 32 years till 2005 to the day. Actually,
wow.
32 years to the day.
Wow.
And on sometime in the summer of 2005, I had been the chairman of the firm for 5+ years. And sometime that summer, I just said, this is enough fun. I want to do something a little more kingdom directed.
Mm-hmm.
And so after eight plus years in management of chairing the litigation practice and then chairing the firm, and in about April or May of 2005, I decided to leave the firm, step down as chairman, and then my wife and I went to the south of France. And if you're going to think about changing careers, don't go to the south of France because you will change careers. You absolutely will. So I did. I came back and I gave the firm notice and said, I really think it's time for me to do something else. So here I am.
You're here now, on the campus.
Yeah, here I am. So that was in September 1st of 2005, and I've never looked back. I really love being here, and I had no plans on being here when I stepped down. I couldn't have found Westminster on the map. I knew very little about it other than the fact that in Williamsburg, we were the third and fourth attendees at the Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which was a newfound plant by a recent Westminster grad named Mort Whitman.
Oh, wow.
So even though I was a Wheaton grad, I knew nothing about the Reformed faith. Wheaton's a broadly evangelical school, as you know, but it's not a Reformed school in any real sense. So Mort Whitman planted Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in the fall of 1970 or 69, I guess, and he had somehow gotten two people to come before in the first year. And then in the second year, my wife and I were the third and the fourth or the fifth and the sixth. I don't remember. But significantly, the first and second were Reggie Kidd, who teaches New Testament at
RTS, right?
RTS, and is a long, long time friend. And the other was a fellow named Lem Tucker, who also came here and went to a seminary, went down and worked with John Perkins at Voice of Calvary in Mississippi and died a very early and tragic death of some type of leukemia. But those were members one and two, both ultimately Westminster students, mm-hmm. and my wife and I joined, and we had a nice little fellowship of about 20 over the course of 3 years. So I became familiar with the Reformed gospel at Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Williamsburg, Virginia. Yeah.
That's fantastic. So now what are some of the cases you've worked on? Before we get into the idea of, you mentioned a kingdom perspective and wanting to do more of that, and we'd like to get into the intricacies of actually practicing law and doing it self-consciously as a Christian and how that's appropriate or can be appropriate. But before that, what are some of the cases you worked on and what type of law did you practice? Because there are many different types.
It evolved over the course of time from 1973 on my entire career. I was in the litigation practice, so I was what you would call a trial lawyer, although trial lawyers are typically thought of as being plaintiff's lawyers. Trial lawyers can be defendant's lawyers, too. And a large firm like I was in, it typically was defense-oriented. I started out doing criminal antitrust and securities cases. I did employment cases. Long before there was such a thing as intellectual property, I tried some high-tech cases, we called them then, but they would clearly be intellectual property cases today. But I think my career can be summarized by three words: drugs, sludge, and radiation. I did drugs, I did sludge, and I did radiation.
Not personally.
Right. Well, I'll explain that. You can draw your own conclusions.
All right.
On March 28, 1979, I remember waking up, hearing the radio go on, and somebody saying there's been an accident out at Three Mile Island, which you guys have heard of, at least.
Absolutely.
You may not have been alive when it happened, but you've heard of it. And I remember thinking, boy, that's going to be some big deal. I wonder who represents them. Well, turns out my firm represented them, and I got in there early that day for reasons I can't remember, and there was about three messages on my desk of see so-and-so right now. I was a fairly senior associate in 1979. I became a partner in the firm in 1980. So it turned out to be the next, I guess it would have been 79 to probably 98, so that's 19 years of my life. I spent probably 30 to 40% of my time representing the owners and operators of Three Mile Island. So it was. I became very familiar, obviously, with nuclear reactors and nuclear power and radiation and all those things. So that was the radiation part of my practice. Uh-huh. I did drugs consistently from 1975. I represented Merck and Johnson & Johnson and others, but primarily in drug products defense.
Yeah.
So I tried cases.
A lot of intellectual property there.
Yeah. Actually, those weren't the cases I was thinking of, but there is a lot of intellectual property there. But they're basically drug injury cases.
Yeah, okay.
So I would represent, for example, I had a string of cases representing Johnson & Johnson's sub McNeil, which is right around here in Fort Washington, on their so-called Tylenol alcohol cases. There was an allegation that alcohol potentiated the effects of Tylenol and conjugated it in the liver in a manner that could be a liver destroyer.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of those, and the whole issue there was, do they need to put a warning, an alcohol warning on the label, which I believe is there now ultimately, but I've tried a lot of those cases and dealt with a lot of those and a lot of other types of drug cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably another 25, 30% of my practice. Then a lot of the rest of my practice was sludge. I was the king of sludge. I represented, back in the 80s and 90s, the major issue, one of the major issues in America was who's going to clean up the rivers, the polluted harbors, the all of the waste sites and Superfund sites. Who's going to pay for that? Is it going to be the people that did it? or is it going to be their insurers who issued them general liability policies for 40 years?
Yeah.
And are typically accident or occurrence policies and not thought about as something that would cover generally acts that were done intentionally, but the outcome wouldn't have been known. So it was a massive, and it may still be, but in the 90s, in the late 80s and 90s, it was a huge issue. There was major litigation between insurers who I represented and polluters as to who would pay. So that's what I call the sludge part of my practice. So it was, again, drugs, sludge, radiation. Easy to remember.
Easy to remember.
It's great at cocktail parties, too. What do you do? Well, I do drugs, I do sludge, I do radiation. It's real simple.
I didn't. Sometimes all at the same time.
I didn't need to refer to anything to remember what my practice was.
Well, I hate to clue you in, but as we discuss Christians in law, maybe if you're not aware, our culture uses lawyers as the butt of many of its jokes.
Yes. No, I wasn't aware of that, Camden. What a novel thought.
Indeed. Yeah. In the apologetics course here, AP 213, which is the second apologetics course that you're required to take, Dr. Oliphant speaks about Thomas Aquinas and what is called the analogia entis, which is the analogy of being. And there are different interpretations of this idea, but if I were to boil it down simplistically, some may disagree, but that there is a chain of being. God is unlimited being, and all other beings descend in some sort of chain of being until you get to the bottom of the chain of being, at which point Dr. Oliphant says you find the lawyers. So that's just one theological take on the typical butt of the joke. Could insert all sorts of professions.
Well, just one short snapshot, and that was when Dr. Carl Truman, acting in his official capacity, got served with a subpoena to produce documents on behalf of the institution. He called me up in a panic, and he's, of course, the greatest lawyer detractor on campus. And I said, well, why don't you just call one of your theologians? Why are you calling a lawyer?
I would have loved to hear that.
You need me now.
He called me up and he said, what do I do? I said, well, call a theologian.
Just pray.
Or pray, yeah. I should have. Oh, why didn't I think of that? But he said, no, Jim, I really need help. What do I do? And I said, well, we'll figure it out.
So and then you worked through the issue.
Of course we did.
Yeah, but of course, it's not a bad thing to leave Dr. Truman hanging once in a while, given all the abuse he shovels out himself.
He has his issues with lawyers, as we all know.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Now, speaking of law in general, we're talking about laws that are instituted by men, by governments, but what are the foundations of law? Maybe it's an easy question, but why do we need it, and how do we go about it as Christians? What are the foundations?
Well, of course, U.S. law is based upon the common law, which has evolved over centuries in England, and it's basically the common law is unwritten. It's all case law, case generated, and it started out essentially is two things, ex contractu and ex delictu, contractual law and tort law. Hmm. And all of our laws have basically come down through our heritage as a British colony, essentially. All of the common law has been imported, and we've, of course, developed our own sense of English common law, and much of it's been codified now. But essentially, our foundations in the law are from the English common law. And each state had its own set of laws and has enacted its own set of laws, some of which are different. For example, the laws of New Jersey will be different than the laws of Pennsylvania in many ways. The laws of New Jersey tend to be more progressive than the laws in Pennsylvania. Mm. Of course, overlaying all of that is the federal system to which all Americans are subject. So. And then, of course, there's New Orleans or Louisiana, which has a French background. So it's not a common law jurisdiction. It's a codified French law jurisdiction. So when you try a case in Louisiana like I have, you're met with a whole different set of words and phrases that you're not familiar with, laws that you're not familiar with. In other words, they're not, even though there certainly have been inroads, they are not followers of the English common law as the other 49 states are. So it's a mix of things, but I would say foundationally our laws are built upon the English system, which has been, of course, intact for ever since the Magna Carta, when the landed gentry got King John to sign the Magna Carta, giving them certain rights. It's been an evolutionary process since then.
That's interesting to think about the history and development of laws and how they pass from governments to governments. And when you start to unwrap the onion, so to speak, to peel the layers off, we're going to go all the way back to the very beginnings of humanity when God created the earth. What are some common elements or some general principles our Declaration of Independence speaks of certain inalienable rights that we have as human beings? What are some of those really basic, even philosophical or theological foundations for the idea of a law that should govern the conduct of men?
Well, I think it's very interesting. Take the first 10 amendments, for example, passed at the same time that the Constitution was adopted. So you start with the right of free speech, the right against unreasonable searches, the right to a jury by your peers. Terribly important thing, because that was not common in England. And that was one of the issues that was hugely important to the colonists, that they would not be summoned by the regent or the governor to stand trial. They would have the right to trial by a jury of their peers. Hugely important thing. Again, a right against unreasonable searches and seizures, the Fourth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination. In another very important one, it's commonly called the separation of church and state, but of course those words nowhere appear in the Constitution or the any of the amendments. Those are judicially coined phrases. That's a judicially coined phrase. It's the right to be free in your religious practice, as stated in the First Amendment. So I think those are some of the really important ones that we have seen come down over time.
I can imagine as you're learning law and you're going through law school, and even as you're in your practice, of course, there's a huge overlap with ethical issues and their systems of ethics. Have you found in your time as being a lawyer that you've come to butt heads with people who are coming from different philosophical perspectives, and you as a Christian have a certain understanding of how God created the world and how he's instituted certain things, and other people might have a completely different account for what is right and what is wrong? Have you found that to be the case?
Interesting question, Camden. Lawyers are governed by a very strict code of conduct. It's not quite the same in every state, but every state has them. And Pennsylvania has essentially adopted the so-called model rules, which are the rules of professional conduct, or the RPC. Very detailed in terms of what representation means, to whom you can give confidential information, where your duties of loyalty are, what constitutes a conflict of interest, right down to the details of engagement letters and everything else. So we're a fairly tightly governed group of people. And every year, to maintain my license, and this is going to be my 39th year of doing this, I have to go back and take 12 hours, including 1 hour of ethics, which...
12 hours a year?
12 hours of continuing legal education a year.
Actual classroom hours or credit hours?
Yeah, classroom hours, not credit hours. Classroom hours. So that's basically that's basically 2 days.
Still,
2 days it takes, and mine's coming up in a couple of weeks. I got to do it. But one of those classes is ethics, and they call 11 of them are substantive in whatever field you want to study in. But one of them is ethics. But I will say that lawyers, I think, get a bad reputation, and I have found that in most firms, particularly the big firms like mine, and mine was what you would call a classic white shoe firm. It was founded in 1849, so it's what is that, 160 some years old.
62 years,
And in fact, just parenthetically, the fellow who I have retained to represent the seminary on a number of issues, his name is Bill Bullitt. his great-great-grandfather, John C. Bullitt, founded the firm in 1849. Wow. So it's been a it's a firm that's been going on for years and years and years. It changed its name to Drinker, Biddle, and Reath in the in 1920 when Henry Drinker and Charlie Biddle got together and formed the firm. But basically, this all has a point, I promise. legal ethics started evolving in the 20s and 30s, and they started evolving literally at Drinker, Biddle, and Reath for the country. And the reason was Henry Drinker, who's the senior name partner and long dead, had an issue with the way law was being practiced in some quarters and by some ethnicities in the city of Philadelphia primarily. And so he was named the chairman of the first American Bar Association Committee on Ethics. And for about 30 or 40 years, he chaired that committee. When he stepped down, our senior partner at the time, Lou Van Dusen, chaired it for the next 20 years. And when he stepped down, Larry Fox, another partner, chaired it for 10 years. So we've had like 70 or the last 70 years, the chairman of that ABA Committee on Ethics, or different names, but essentially in ethics, have been Drinker lawyers. So Drinker wrote the book on ethics, and Drinker has had this long sort of history of being known for its, well, poor way to put it,
pioneering,
but for its
really,
ethics, though. But its pioneering work in writing the model rules and having them enacted and all, and running the committee that oversees it. So you grow up in a culture at a place like Drinker that ethics are very, it comes with, you bleed the colors and it's kind of in the water. It's in the DNA of the firm. But I would say even beyond a place like Drinker, ethics are taken very seriously. And when there is a breach, it can be fairly high, it can be fairly high profile. Now, there are always going to be people in any profession that that skirt the law. I'll never forget an article I saw once in the American Lawyer, which is the rag that many of us read when and then flush down the toilet or do whatever we do with it, about a slip and fall lawyer in New York City.
Slip and fall lawyer.
Because the rule in New York was in order to if you were claiming a defect in the sidewalk, the hole had to be 3 inches deep. If it was less than 3 inches, it wasn't. So what plaintiff's lawyers would do would take would be to take rulers and measure them. And they caught this one guy because he'd made his own ruler. And he'd taken a picture of it, but in fact it was only two, but it showed five on his ruler. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you just can't make up. And I remember
this
thinking,
is what they do on fishing websites when when they show their catch.
I mean, that's a silly little story, but stuff like that does happen. But I have found, for the most part, probably more so in the culture that I grew up in at the Drinker, Biddle, and Reath, that lawyers tend to be very ethical. The chief types of questions you get are conflict questions, and they can be difficult. We represent we represent client X. Can we represent client Y? Obviously, not if they're in direct conflict with each other, but in some cases there's such a thing as a waivable conflict. So if there's a possibility that they may come in conflict later, if both parties assent or consent, you can represent both parties.
I see.
But and typically, you know what I did for you when you asked me to do the
to be on our board, and now you're on our advisory board,
and to write the agreement. I said the Westminster is my client, so you will need to give me a written consent, which of course you did. But that's the place where you most often see ethics come in, and it's the issue is, if you do this for this client, can you do this for that client? And think about it. A firm like mine probably has 10 or 15,000 clients. Some of the really large firms maybe have 20 or 25,000 clients.
Oh, my word.
So you have to have a whole group of people. We had about five people that did nothing but check conflicts. It's their job. Intake, we called it. And all they did was check conflicts against the books. And then we got conflict sheets every morning that we had to read through. And so that's a big part of the practice these days.
That's taken seriously. Absolutely.
It's taken, in the large firms, it's taken very, very seriously. Now, I think it's less of an issue in the conflict if you're a solo practitioner, if you're representing injured people. You don't generally have those types of conflicts issues. You may have different types of issues, but you don't have that type of issue.
Yeah.
Is that a good start?
Yeah. Start talking about that, we can further plumb the idea of conflicts and perhaps down the road, I'll let Jared speak here, but we could speak about even conflicts that might arise if we're put in a sort of a predicament when we're demanded from the firm or by the law to do one thing where sometimes it might even come into conflict with our Christian convictions. But Jared?
Yeah. Wanted to ask a related, kind of an underlying question. I worked with a guy who was in law school, and this was just after coming out of seminary, graduating from seminary. And it struck me how what I did sometimes in seminary in hermeneutics and interpreting scripture, there's somewhat of a parallel with legal work in that there's a canon of information, there's interpreting that. And even in the philosophical world, there's, evidences that you're looking at and there's a case that you're making. I guess the question is, have you taken some of those skills that you've learned in the legal world and being involved in a theological seminary? Are there parallels that you see and can you apply those to the theological arena in ways that maybe we can't see initially?
Yeah, that's great.
And even in sitting in the ethics class that you're doing, how those things are related.
Wow, ethics class is very stimulating. I didn't realize the rule was that you only put verses up on the board in Greek and Hebrew, so I'm right away I'm dead.
It's very difficult.
That's an interesting question, and I guess I would answer it this way. When I started practicing, there was no Lexis or Nexus, no online search, no computers. Mm-hmm. There was no computers. There was no – we did typewriters. I'm sounding like a really old guy. I guess I am, but we did typewriters in 7 carbon papers. That's how old. And there was – I'm not even sure there was a Xerox – well, maybe early Xerox machines, but see – the whole notion of legal research, everything now is done the same way we do it here. The books are there and they're nice, but legal research is essentially done online. So I can find anything I need now online. Used to be that libraries were hugely important, and you'd go into the library and you'd find a book and to see if that case was still good. For example, if you read a Supreme Court case that in 1965, to see if that case was still good law, you would have to go to a second book called A Shepherd's and shepherdize it, which would tell you right up to the minute or up to the week whether that case was still good law. So you'd read
the Norman Shepherd?
No, it wasn't Norman Shepherd.
The Shepherd Leader by Whitmer.
I heard Shepherd.
These are dumb theological.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the Shepherd controversy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, it sounds so laborious. I mean, it was
very laborious. It was unbelievably laborious. That's why they had
this
associates.
Paralegals or assistants and all sorts of other people.
It was brutal. But so that has evolved to the point where when my firm moved about the first year I became chairman, we moved and I questioned whether we should even build a library. Well, we built a lovely library. It's very pretty. We hold receptions in there. At least that's what we were doing when I left. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else they do. Very few people go in there because everything you need is at your fingertips. Now, I don't know if that's the same way it is in the seminary, to come right down to the question now that I've been blathering on. I don't know if it's the same, because what I am doing, I'm simply auditing the ethics class at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm not going out and doing any independent research. So I just don't know if there's a carryover there in study methods. I will say that there certainly is a carryover in the legal work that I do for the seminary. Mm-hmm. I do all sorts of things for the seminary. I do the copyright work. I do the publications work. I do trademark work. Personnel work, contracts, you name it. Mm-hmm. I do that. And much of the information that I need to do it, I can find on site, or I can make a call to one of my former colleagues whom the seminary has retained to help me with the things that I'm not competent on.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I guess the short answer is I don't I'm not sure that there's a clean overlay in this.
Okay.
In law and the seminary studies.
One way, kind of simply, that I can ask it is, does a lawyer read scripture in a way that's articulately different from, you know, someone else who may not have the same kind of background and skills?
I see. That's a very interesting question. I've seen tremendous scripture parsing in the good sense here.
Uh-huh.
And lawyers do exactly the same
thing. Right, right. Okay,
They parse words very carefully. My wife often says to me, "You're thinking like a lawyer and talking like a lawyer again. Would you quit it?" And I said, "Come on, that's all I am. It's the only thing I know." But we do tend to be very careful about what we say in certain issues, just like a theologian would be. I'd say much more so than is common typically, because words matter, nuances matter, etc.
One of the things that often comes up when it's time to nominate a new Supreme Court justice is their position on the law or their approach. You hear of liberal judges and conservative judges or constitutionalists. I mean, really what's going on is a matter of hermeneutics.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating the differences of opinion that come up. I recall several years ago when Senator Kennedy was still alive and he was speaking in behalf of, I forget the justice name, but you can remind me, but it was maybe 5 years ago. And defending this idea of a progressive approach to law in which the judge will, he was defending the idea of, in a sense, legislating for the bench or updating the law for today's culture. And so we have in law the same types of issues we have in people approaching the Bible. You have different ideas of what a text means or what its meaning is for today or how we are supposed to treat it. Could you speak to that just in terms of how you might go, how you might practice yourself or how you might hire people for your firm or how you might support or not support a particular judge based on their hermeneutic?
And it depends on what your definition of is.
Well, he's a lawyer too.
That's why I brought it up.
He's disbarred, but he is law trained, shall we say.
Yeah. But there are, you know,
yeah,
there's something
right.
to it.
Yeah, you're right.
That's a very interesting question because the fight today is between the so-called originalists, the Scalia wing of the court, which generally is sought to compose Alito, Scalia, Roberts, and Clarence Thomas, and the Living Constitution or something group, which Ginsburg and Sotomayor and Stephen Breyer and, well, John Paul Stevens was, and David Souter also came out of that mold. And the really interesting point is many constitutional issues are decided by one person today.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know who that is? Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah.
Who's the so-called swing vote, just like Justice O'Connor.
O'Connor was for so many
the swing
years.
Vote for years. So the thinking is that if Obamacare is unconstitutional, it's going to be 5-4 and it's going to be Justice Kennedy writing, and if it's constitutional, it's going to be 5-4, and it's going to be probably Chief Justice Roberts, because in the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice has the power to assign the opinion if he's in the majority.
If he's in the majority.
And I think the senior minority justice assigns the opinion otherwise. But coming back to the whole notion of originalism versus a living constitution, it's a very interesting dynamic right now, and what you hear from the liberal side and the progressive side is that the world's changed in 220 years. We cannot simply take the Constitution literally as you originalists want to take it. It needs to grow and expand and adapt to the times. And of course, on the other side, you get the argument that's judge making law.
Yeah, we have a legislative branch.
Yeah, we have a legislative branch. You guys aren't the legislative. We're not the legislative branch. We are here to interpret the laws made by the legislature, and you can see, for example, in the Commerce Clause, what's happened in the recent years. The Commerce Clause, since the 1930s and the New Deal, has been stretched beyond all recognition. Originally, the Commerce Clause was to regulate commerce between the states with a foreign country, and thirdly, with the Indian tribes. That's what it says. Yeah. Now, it's fine to have judicial gloss and all, but to the point where now we are being told that we have to buy a product, which of course is the current state of the mandate under Obamacare. That's as far as the Commerce Clause has ever been stretched, by far. It takes it beyond anywhere it's ever been. In fact, one of the judges, Judge Gladys Kessler, I think is her name, who found Obamacare constitutional, one of the two or three that did, and there's two that didn't, I think, she said it shouldn't depend on whether there's an activity or a non-activity, because engaging in a non-activity is mental activity, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And the Commerce Clause governs mental activity.
Huh.
So there's the interesting sort of dynamic, originalists versus living constitutions. Now, nobody's a true originalist, and nobody believes you should just ignore the Constitution either. Yeah. So the issue is where in that line do you come? A guy like Scalia would be pretty far over to the right in that line, and somebody like Anthony Kennedy, who's considered the swing vote, would probably be in that camp, but would be much further to the left.
And have you
line.
Found your own Christian convictions and your understanding of what a text is, or what its authority is, or where it lies? Do you find your Christian convictions impacting your understanding of how we approach a legal text?
No, you know, I don't. I know a number of Christian lawyers who tend to be on the liberal side.
Really?
And I know, so I don't think how you interpret the Constitution itself is a Christian issue. For me, it's much more a constitutional issue of executive, judiciary,
yeah, right,
and legislative, and it's a usurpation of powers issue to me. It's not a biblical or a religious issue.
So do you find it more of a pragmatic issue? Then I'm trying to get at how you approach mm-hmm. text. Do you find that when you approach, or you have a certain hermeneutic? Do you find personally that you can have a certain hermeneutic in the practice of law and then a different one when you approach your scripture? Or is the science of interpretation or the principles of interpretation, do you find the same in both cases?
Guy's pretty smart.
You're leading me in the right direction, and I
hadn't thought about it.
A leading question, Your Honor?
No, I asked an
it wasn't a leading. It wasn't a leading question, actually. A leading question is one that suggests an answer, and that didn't suggest an answer.
I stand corrected.
That's technically what a leading question is.
So I win that.
Well,
can I weigh?
I mean, there are different, you know, standards, right? Because one's interpreting scripture, one is interpreting constitution, which is inerrant or infallible.
Yeah. I really wasn't trying to.
But it's a hermeneutic. No, that's an excellent point. I want to think about it, but off the top of my head, I think my biblical hermeneutic, would persuade me on the way I interpret. I think it would.
In terms of the principles of
in
how
terms
you
of
do
the
it.
Principles.
I'm not saying that you that yeah. it, when you're trying a case, you necessarily look for in a case law in scripture. It's probably not that blunt. But the idea that you approach the text in a certain way, your principles for interpretation, you're saying are probably the same,
I think,
at least would impact.
Yeah. Of course, you've got the inspired and inerrant word of God in one hand. So it's fundamentally different, but you do I have a high view of scripture, much higher now since I've been here than I did before, but I've always had a high view. But I think the Constitution is such an utterly remarkable document and so well thought out that I have a high view of the Constitution. So I think my hermeneutic of looking at the Bible would translate to my hermeneutic of looking at the Constitution and being more on the originalist side than, say, some of my also Christian brothers, but that would be more on the liberal side of that.
Interesting. Jared?
I'd like to give just a specific example. Say you had a protege who was a lawyer and dealt with divorce cases, and there was a quote-unquote no-fault divorce case. How would you go about advising a Christian lawyer to deal with a no-fault divorce case, given own personal Christian convictions, but also working within the law and the rules and governance?
The ethics
there.
All involved there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I say
Yeah, we have, I'm sure, plenty of ethical conundrums we could raise, but this is an interesting case because I think it gets to the gets to the heart of the issue.
It does, and I will answer that because I do have thoughts on that. But as chairman of a firm of 550 people, which I was, mm-hmm. with everybody from neo-communists or neo-socialists to right-wingers and a broad spectrum of people, all of whom were my partners and I owed a duty of leadership to, you can imagine that there were many things that came up that I personally did not agree with.
Yes. Yeah.
But that I, in the interest of running a firm and a business, didn't feel like it violated my personal beliefs. Here's a great example. The GLBT group came and wanted us to sponsor them mm-hmm. for Gay Pride. Many of my partners, some of my partners are gay. Many of my associates were gay, and they uniformly asked me to put firm money toward the GLBT. Now, I thought about it a long time, and I said, no, I can't do it. If it's that important an issue, I will step down because that is something that I cannot do. I just don't believe in it, and I don't want on my watch, I can't do it. I just can't do it. So all of my partners knew me as a spiritual or religious guy because I tended to wear it on my sleeve. So everybody knew that it was going to be an issue for me. And while they were disappointed, nobody said to me, step down. We're going to do this. There were a lot of people in the firm that didn't think we ought to do it. So that was one issue. That was one issue where I was able to say, no, this violates my personal beliefs, and I am not going to give firm money to do it. Now, there were other cases. For example, take the divorce case. I don't do divorce cases, but if we had a divorce practice, a very small divorce practice, and if my partners wanted to do no fault divorce cases, that was okay. That didn't violate for me any of my personal tenets. So I think like everything else, you've got to make some hard decisions that are not bright line decisions.
Yeah.
But you just go ahead and make them as they come.
Sure.
You pray about them. You talk to your. I had some good Christian friends in the firm that I talked to regularly about tough issues. I had a group of secretaries that prayed for me every day. Isn't that wonderful?
It is.
Wow. She came to me, the woman that ran the pool. She came to me and she said, "Do you know that 6 of us get together and pray for you every day?" I said, "Oh my, that's wonderful! Wow. That's the best thing I've heard."
Yeah. It's quite a compliment.
It really was. So I every day I felt as I went into work. After my devotions, the first thing I would say was, Lord help me, whatever. There can be some tough decisions. I'm not going to please everybody. Uh-huh. I'm going to make some wrong. I'm going to make some right. I may compromise my principles. But if you have a set of principles laid out and you consciously try to make the right decision, that's all you can do. And that's what I tried to do.
I know I don't intend to pepper you with particular instances, but along that line...
Hypos, let's do hypos.
Yeah, right. Counterfactuals or whatnot. One other case that I would like to ask you about, you spoke about how your firm, for the most part, often was characterized by being on the defense side of things. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with the morality or the ethics of defense? For instance, if you... I'm not saying you did any criminal cases of this sort, but let's pretend that somebody who was accused of murder is asking you to defend them in a criminal case, and it comes out that you find that they indeed did it. They tell you under client privilege, lawyer-client privilege, that they did it, but they're pleading not guilty. Mm-hmm. Right? How do you deal with this? Is that something you would find yourself personally not willing to do, or is there a certain duty you find to the law to give this person a fair trial, even though you disagree and would like to see them personally put away?
Good question. The answer is that, as a practical matter, most defense lawyers never ask their clients.
Really?
Yes, they don't. They don't. They may know in their hearts, but... The good ones that I've talked to, because I've asked that same question, I've never had a murder case. Very little criminal law, but no murder cases. But most of them don't ask.
They don't ask.
They don't ask.
That's fascinating.
And you can you can absolutely defend somebody even if you believe they have committed a crime. And the reason you can is because under our system, you're innocent, presumed innocent, until proven guilty, and the state has the obligation to present credible evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of guilt. So now what I would do practically in a case, if I knew that my guy had committed murder, was I have an absolute obligation not to suborn perjury. So if he goes on the stand and lies, I have to immediately take action. What I would probably do is I would ask for a recess, and I'd figure out at that point what to do. But I cannot allow a client to lie, and that's civil or criminal. So if I know that client is lying, I have to move to withdraw or do something similar like that. So that's.
You think that might be some of the motivation for not asking?
It could be. Yeah. It could very well be. The other thing is, there's an old story of F. Lee Bailey. Do you guys remember F. Lee Bailey? One of the great trial lawyers of his time. He's
heard
dead
the name,
now.
But
he represented the Boston Strangler. Heard of the Boston Strangler?
Yeah.
Boston Strangler was a early time serial killer in the 50s. He knew Albert DeSalvo had done it. And so what he did was he worked very hard to get him committed rather than getting him to jail. So I guess the answer for me is if I thought the guy did it, I would try my best to work out a plea on his behalf, get the best deal I could, understanding that he can go to trial. If he takes the stand voluntarily, remember, he doesn't have to.
Right.
If he takes the stand voluntarily and lies, I have an obligation to do something about it. Now, what I would do would depend on the circumstances, so I can't answer that. And also, of course, in many cases, there's going to be an opportunity for a competency, mental competency defense, like, for example, Jared Loughner, who shot Gabrielle Giffords. I would fully expect there to be a mental competency defense there, as we all would. So you've got a couple of things. The defendant has to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, does not have to testify about himself. If he does, he cannot lie, or you have an obligation to do something. And the government must be put to its test. That's the beauty of our system.
It is. So
it tends to work out pretty well, actually.
Yeah. The more and more I learn about and study the Constitution and the way our law is set up, the more appreciation I have for it. And I think that's the beauty of being an American. For those who aren't Americans, I'm sure there is some beauty and grandeur to other law systems as well. But
it's remarkable how well our common law system and our Constitution has held up for 230-some years now. It's really remarkable.
Now, another hot button issue before we wrap things up is the role of the Ten Commandments. And often you hear about them being, a sculpture of them, or some depiction of the Ten Commandments might be in a courtroom, etc. There are many different opinions of this, even within the Christian community. What is your personal opinion of this, or do you have any ideas about the public display of the Ten Commandments? Is that a good thing, a bad thing, or how do we go about this?
Very interesting question you asked again. And I've got a story. I've got lots of stories on that. But the most famous local Ten Commandments case is the plaque that was on the Chester County Courthouse back in it went on the courthouse in 1925, and in 2002 or one, a group, the Freedom from Religion, the American Atheist Association, filed a suit in federal court in Philadelphia before the Honorable Dalzell Stewart Dalzell, who's a former partner and a friend of mine. And Judge Dalzell, with the county representing itself, and not very well, I might add, didn't represent themselves very well, lost. Ordered to remove the plaque from the courthouse, at which time one of the county commissioners, a fellow named Colin Hanna, who's a Christian, called me up and said, "Who's the best appellate lawyer in Pennsylvania?" And I said, "Got just the guy. He's my partner, Alfie Putnam, who actually succeeded me as chairman of the firm." He said, "Well, we need to file an appeal to this case. So he came in, met with me and with Alfie, and Alfie said, well, I don't want to represent the county because there's certain requirements of putting a record together and all of that, but we will we want to file an amicus, a so-called amicus friend of the court brief. So we'll be the friend of the court. So Colin hired another firm, and we became the carried all the water, and we wrote the brief, and Alfie wrote really one of the classic briefs I've ever read in my life, one of the great briefs, argued it before the Third Circuit and won the case. On primarily on the theory that it just wasn't a big deal. Yeah.
The not a big deal argument. I like that.
I mean, it's not crazy. It's not it's basically, come on, get a life. It's a wonderfully read, written opinion. The judge, I've forgotten who wrote it, but he was a remarkably prolific judge, and he died shortly thereafter. But he wrote the opinion, and essentially the last line was something to the effect of, is this real or is it mere shadow, I think was the word. And he said, this is mere shadow, which essentially said, it's just not a big deal. We're not going to spend the rest of our lives cleaning up our all of our monuments in D.C., scrubbing them clean, and taking In God We Trust off our coins. We're just not going to do that. It's not necessary in our society. That's basically how it came down. And it was a wonderful result. And that those arguments, there were a lot of Ten Commandment cases going around. Those arguments have kind of gone to the rear. The ACLU was representing these parties, and they lost the case, and it was a classic win for Drinker, Biddle, and Reith, I must say. But on the other hand, I just think the level to which we go in this country today to avoid offending somebody is just striking. Just think of the notion you can't pray in public schools anymore. Well, when I was growing up in a public school, we said the pledge. We read a psalm every day. Can you believe that? Read a psalm and had a prayer every day, public schools. And you couldn't imagine that today. No. There were Jews in my class, so we tended to read the Old Testament. But we'd pray, and somebody might essentially forget and say in Jesus' name instead of in the name of God. So those sorts of things would happen, and that was just... that was okay. Nobody cared about Christmas trees and creches. This is all our incredible desire that we've gone to great lengths not to offend anybody. And I think ultimately it's much more technically written than that. But I think ultimately where this boils down to in the Ten Commandments is we don't have to go this far not to offend everybody. I think if you read the case fairly, that's pretty much what it's saying.
Interesting.
No, just observation. It seems like, culture is kind of going towards really one worldview, and that's secularism. And then every other religion is just shunned. I could see, maybe you can comment on this, but another legal way of going about it is, if you can pray in school to the Christian God, can you pray in school to Allah or practice Hinduism or something like that? It just struck me that that's not the way that the culture moved, is pluralism. It was really secular monism.
Yeah,
which itself is its own worldview, own religion of sorts. So.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a fantastic discussion, Jim. Thank you for joining us. It has been a pleasure and kind of a breath of fresh air to talk about a different angle on theology. So thanks for coming by. It's been
my pleasure, Camden and Jared. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. And if you'd like to read more, you can find more information about Jim's practice, his former organization, Drinker, Biddle, and Reith, where he was the former chairperson there. I'm sure there's plenty of information.
I was the chairman. I was not the chairperson.
So nice. We don't mind offending people. That's all right. Well, of course, Jared, you can find information about him and the various work that he's doing at WTS.edu, as well as YouTube.com/Westminster Online and Facebook.com/Westminster Online. And Reformed Forum is available in many places, but the primary place, reformedforum.org. There you can download all of our programs and find more and more of them being produced in video format. So keep your eyes open at the website for more information and new resources there. I want to thank everybody for listening and for watching, and we hope everyone joins us again next time on Christ Center.